Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. The issue of human rights is on the front burner. America is engaged in a war against terrorism, a war that we are told by our leaders will extend for some years to come. It's not over yet. It's not near over yet. And every time we take a prisoner or capture, well, what do you call them, prisoners of war? Unlawful combatants? All these terms are flying around because we're trying to place our enemies within the context of human rights. Where did the concept of human rights come from? That's the first question we'll be answering as we talk with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery during this hour. World religions and human rights is the subject. How does Christianity fare its track record on human rights, and how does that track record compare with that of Islam or Buddhism or Mormonism? Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, Barrister at Law in England and Wales, and member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Where did the concept of human rights come from?
The actual origin of human rights is the creation. That is to say, because God created us in his own image, we are given qualities that deserve to be protected so that no human being has a right to take them away from us, and we don't even have a right to take them away from ourselves. That's the source of the notion of inalienable rights. Rights that must not be alienated or taken away by anybody at all. So there's a theological source for these rights. If there weren't, we wouldn't be able to establish rights at all. I mean, you can't establish, let's say, the rights of fish by having the fish get together and vote that they have certain rights. Rights have got to be provided for from the outside. They can't be something that one creates oneself, because if they are that, then obviously the people who grant them can take them away.
So the beginning of an understanding of the concept of human rights is what rights really are, not self-invented, contrived concepts, but transcendent realities?
Yes, exactly. And I've argued in my book, Human Rights and Human Dignity, therefore, that if you don't have a clear revelation from God, a transcendent word indicating what these rights are, you're always going to have difficulty, because you'll be confusing what is truly transcendent with simply wants or needs that the human being builds up for himself.
We Americans are remarkably short-sighted, especially with regard to history, and I imagine it's a popular concept among Americans to think that when the Declaration of Independence of the U.S. Constitution were penned, this was the first time anyone had come up with the bright idea that self-evident truths among them are that all men are created equal, endowed with certain inalienable rights, if I can get it out there. Is that the first time anyone came up with that bright idea?
No, not at all. One of the reasons that it's easy to be confused on this is that those who drafted the founding documents in the United States believed that they were getting this stuff from nature, from an observation of the human condition. A number of those who were responsible, the most influential ones, were not Christian. They were deists, or as we say in England, deists. They did not believe in the Bible as a special revelation from God. They believed that the revelation had to come from nature. Thomas Paine, for example, spoke of nature, spoke of the book of nature as substituted for the book of Scripture, because Scripture was supposedly a superstitious volume produced by ignorant Jews, you know, and thousands of years ago. And now the age of reason had arrived, the 18th century. So in the Declaration of Independence, we have the mention of nature and nature's God, And nowhere in any of the American founding documents do you have a reference to the Bible or a reference to Jesus Christ. So I think it's easy for Americans to imagine that everything sort of started in the 18th century, and it hardly did. All of those people who developed the founding documents were living off of inherited capital. They were getting all this stuff from the Christian tradition. Had it not been for the Christian tradition, they wouldn't have discovered this in the slightest. And in other traditions, like the Islamic tradition, for example, you don't have a concept of human rights at all.
So is it possible, outside the context of a Judeo-Christian worldview or explicit revelation of the Christian scriptures, is it possible to develop a full-blown bona fide concept of human rights such as we have today?
I don't believe so, and the best evidence of this is that your regional human rights systems exist in those parts of the world that have had Christian influence. So you've got an American human rights, inter-American human rights system. You've got the most distinguished, the European Court of Human Rights, the European human rights system, where I do most of my work. But you don't have any Near Eastern human rights system. There's no Islamic human rights organization. And you don't have any Far Eastern human rights system. Among the Chinese or Far Eastern peoples, there isn't anything like that. And I think that that's significant. It's similar to the fact that modern science developed only within the Christian West. There was technology in other parts of the world, as in China, but you don't have anything like the Western scientific tradition. And when you discover things like this, you have to ask, well, what is it about the religious position that had that sort of influence?
So let's get a bare-bones definition of human rights. What would that be, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, human rights are those characteristics that human beings have been given by God, which are inherent to them, such that no one has a right to take them away, and the individual has no right to give them up.
Among them, how would you articulate those rights? What would they be, basically?
For Americans, the easiest way to get at this is to go to the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And the French Declaration of the Rights of Man sets forth very much the same sort of thing. And the European Convention or Treaty on Human Rights does this, so that you have such rights as the right to life, which is represented in the American Bill of Rights by the right to one's person. This means it's that no one's got a right to kill you or to harm you, and you don't have the right either to encourage that or bring it about. Historically, in the Western tradition, suicide was a felony. Because that was against the right that we all have for the retention of life, and all the various civil liberties, the right to free expression, the right to own property, the right to retain what one has earned so that property cannot be taken away without just cause, et cetera, et cetera.
So if we compare these good articulations of human rights, be they from the American historical context or other nations, other commonwealths, we find a common denominator among all of them. Is that right?
Yes, that's quite right. But the common denominator is due to the fact that you have a common origin.
Okay, so there is the fingerprint of a Judeo-Christian worldview on all of these.
Yes, there is. No question about it. Fascinatingly enough, when the European Human Rights Treaty was drafted, and also the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations, one of the most influential people involved in that was René Cassin, C-A-S-S-I-N. René Cassin. He was an associate of de Gaulle in London during the during the Second World War, when the French government was in exile in London, and Cassin, after he had had such a tremendous impact on these fundamental human rights documents, wrote about his sources. And he said he was a Jew in background, and he said, I started out with the Ten Commandments. In other words, he consciously went back to revelational sources in order to get this kind of thing.
When we come back from this break, I want to discuss, and maybe this is a problem, maybe it isn't, but I think especially today in the American context, people are confusing inalienable rights, as articulated by our founding documents, with unlimited rights. In other words, I have the right to claim any right unto myself that I want to, rather than having these things spelled out and having a true foundation. And I wonder how that's any different from someone who says they just make up their own rights. We're talking about the world religions and human rights. And after the break, we'll also look at the track record of Christianity in Western civilization and elsewhere with regard to human rights. And then we'll compare that with the track record of other world religions, namely Islam or Buddhism. And let's compare it while we're at it, since they're in so much in the news lately, with the track record of Mormonism on human rights. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is my guest. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, Barrister at Law in England and Wales, and member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
The following program is a recorded broadcast. Please do not attempt to call the program. Phone lines are not open.
Next week on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss preaching versus Bible study. Sometimes you can't tell the difference between the two. Dr. Carl Fikencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be my guest. Have pastors historically preached by opening the Bible and preaching verse by verse? It's called expository preaching. What's the danger of this type of preaching? What are the advantages of proclamation beyond Bible study in preaching? We'll talk about it next week on Issues Etc. Dr. Carl Fikencher will be our guest. Now, if you'd like to know what we're going to be discussing on the program each week through the month of March, you can go to our website at issuesetc.org. There you'll find a list of topics and guests for the weeks ahead. While you're there, be sure to read a chapter from Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's book called Human Rights and Human Dignity. Go to the section titled What's New, and there you'll find this chapter titled The Essentiality of Transcendence and the Failure of Religious Answers. The website address again is issuesetc.org. Dr. Montgomery, I don't know if this is just, you know, a mistake I've made of observation or whether or not it's really true. We have parties in the United States like the Libertarian Party and others that seem to have confused inalienable rights with unlimited rights. Do you think that's true?
They certainly do make that mistake. Very, very few rights are unlimited in nature. If you look at the European Convention on Human Rights, for example, virtually all of the articles consist of two paragraphs. The first sets forth the right, and the second sets forth the qualifications of the right. So, for example, let's take the one that I deal with, Article 9, that has to do with religious freedom. religious freedom is stated in very, very firm terms. It is possible for one not only to believe what one wishes to, but also to proclaim and engage in evangelism and that sort of thing. That's paragraph one. But then paragraph two says, nevertheless, governments may limit this right on the basis of public order or the rights of others. Now, what that means, of course, is that if I happen to be an Aztec and one of the tenets of my faith is human sacrifice and I want to sacrifice you, I'm not going to be able to do it. And I can't use religious freedom as an argument. That right, like other rights, will be limited by virtue of other rights or other interests.
This is an extremely common confusion, especially among Christians, and with, sometimes with regard to religious freedom. They say, well, we're religiously free. We don't have to pay property taxes on the church, or I mean, if we violate certain tax codes.
Sure. Sure, and this is a lot of nonsense. This was the Mormon argument. You mentioned the Mormons. This was the Mormon argument of the 19th century in regard to polygamy. They said polygamy is an essential part of our beliefs, and we should have that protected on the basis of the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court of the United States said, you can believe it in your heart if you'd like to, no problem, but you practice this and you're going to go to the federal penitentiary. And I believe that recently we have an incident of a Utah gentleman who was marrying right, left, and center, including the daughter of one of his other wives, and I believe that he is now in the penitentiary.
On the other end of the spectrum, that's the right. On the left, the advocates of cultural relativism will say it's imperialistic for you to impose your Judeo-Christian concept of human rights on others, especially on other nations. How do you respond to that?
Well, if it's true, then an imposition, I suppose, would be an advantage rather than disadvantage. I happen to be a bit of an imperialist, not merely because I'm also a British citizen, but I firmly believe that where a nation or a culture has proper values and another nation doesn't, if the First Nation provides those values to the other, it's doing them a tremendous benefit. You know, it's interesting to see in former colonial areas that the problems were immensely less under the colonial rule than they've been since these nations have jettisoned the Western values and gone on their own. In Africa, for example, there have been horrors that never approximate in any way the sorts of things that took place during the colonial period.
Many Christians, especially here in America, fear a concept of international human rights because it smacks to them of one world government or, who knows, one world religion. How would you respond to that?
Well, Americans are exceedingly naive in taking that kind of view. International human rights have exactly the same sources as American human rights. These sources are scriptural. And the fact is that no nation is perfect in the human rights sphere. The United States and Great Britain are probably the finest examples of countries with civil liberties anywhere in the world. But nobody is perfect. Doctrine of Original Sin makes that clear, and therefore there are instances where even the United States needs the assistance of an international human rights standard. One example of this, abortion law in the United States permits abortion on demand as a result of Roe versus Wade. The Inter-American Treaty on Human Rights states that human life is to be protected in general from the moment of conception. The U.S. never ratified the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights because it was recognized that if this took place, the U.S. could be brought before the bar of the Inter-American Court of Justice for violating that particular right. This is an instance where, in the United States, a human right is not recognized to the same extent as it is elsewhere.
So if Christians are looking outside the United States to, say, China, and talk about the violations of human rights there, religious rights, others, they ought to equally notice a violation of basic human rights within our country in the form of legalized abortion.
Yes, no question about this. But you know, it's amazing how many naive Americans, especially evangelicals, are convinced that somehow the United States is God's country, and anything that goes on, any decision made, has got to be right, and anything that comes from anywhere else has got to be wrong. It doesn't seem to me that that is very consistent with the picture that you get in Scripture, that there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither bond nor free, neither male nor female. You're all one in Jesus Christ. The Bible is international in the sense of placing all people on exactly the same level. But I don't notice this particularly for some of our American friends. For several years, I taught the summer session for Regent University. That's the Pat Robertson University, formerly CBN University in Virginia. And the students came over from there. These were graduate law students. And they were the most impossible chauvinists I think I ever met. They were absolutely convinced that the U.S. was right in everything. Other countries were wrong. They were frightened to death of anything international. Trying to teach them international human rights was sort of like trying to teach Himmler the history of the Jews.
Well, we're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Never at a loss for words in a good soundbite, just like that one. Those are the kind I put in my pocket and remember. Talk to that, you know, when we go to the cocktail parties, these are the kinds I pull out from my good friend, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. When we come back from the break, historically, how has Christianity fared on the issue of human rights? Folks, if you enjoy Christian apologetics, the defending of the Christian faith, that's what we're doing during this hour when we talk about human rights. You need to get the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. The latest issue contains tape and book resources on answering objections to miracles, Pascal's wager, the psychology of atheism, and much more. So you can call during this break, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172, and ask to receive a free copy of the Issues Etc. Journal. I've also written two articles in this latest journal, one titled The Gospel in the Background, where I deal with seeker-oriented evangelism. Does it lead to the preaching, the proclamation of the gospel at every opportunity? And another dealing with September 11th, is God trying to tell us something? Plus, Dr. Ken Cherb chimes in. He's a regular guest on the program. He's written an article on Martin Luther and anti-Semitism. Call now during this break, 1-800-737-0172. Get a free copy of the Issues Etc. Journal.
International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the importance of Issues Etc.
Before settling in England and France, I had my own Christian radio program for 10 years in California and 2 years in Washington State. I was also a regular for over a decade on national religious television. In a word, I have had a great deal of contact with evangelical programming, both good and bad, and my judgment in this area is probably worth something. In my opinion, Issues Etc. is one of the very few programs on Christian radio willing to discuss tough questions with solid theological answers. I consider it a great privilege to be able to appear on the program regularly, and I commend it to every serious listener.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift this week. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can make a credit card donation by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Here's what noted author and social critic Gil Mylander has to say about our Issues Etc. book of the month for June. Reasonable Ethics can be read with pleasure and profit both by those seeking help in thinking about culture in Christian ways and by those looking for insight into the way we live today. Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out what others have to say about reasonable ethics on our website, issuesetc.org. Reasonable ethics costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Is it reasonable to say, I'm a pro-choice Christian? Find out with Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns by Robert Benny. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Reasonable Ethics, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June.
Advances in surgical procedures have reached the point where doctors can safely operate on babies who aren't even born yet.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
At fetal surgery centers across the United States, doctors specialize in the surgical treatment and care of unborn babies and their mothers, correcting some birth defects and, in many cases, saving the child's life. Such advances in care for unborn children and their mothers stand as the starkest contrast to abortion yet and make the life of the unborn baby undeniable to even the staunchest supporter of abortion.
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Why did the early Christian church grow at a phenomenal pace? And why did those first disciples, those unschooled, ever-arguing disciples, stick to their story about Christ even to the point of death? Again, why did the first century non-Christian authors Pliny and Tacitus allude to something highly unusual happening after the crucifixion of Jesus? And one more. Why did opponents of the first Christians never dispute that Jesus' tomb was empty? Jewish stories claim Jesus hadn't really died. He was in a coma and then left the tomb. Others claim that Jesus' body had been stolen. What is never disputed is a report that the tomb was empty. Why did all these things happen? Shenanigans. That's the answer in the media era these days. To establish their power and privilege, the first Christians took a very human Jesus and spun him into the deity subsequent millennia have worshipped. Certainly, there was no such thing as a resurrection. Or so the new revealers of truth want us to believe. But those why questions linger, and the one answer to them all is that God surprised the world with hope by raising Jesus from the dead. I'm thinking about the resurrection, because on this date, June the 8th, in 632 A.D., the prophet Muhammad died. And he is still dead. Thanks for thinking. I'm Dale Meyer.
The Voyage of Learning Teachers Academy is an 8-day experience in Forest Park. Teachers will discover the wonders of Forest Park and learn how to make Forest Park their outdoor classroom. The voyage begins with a rendezvous on Thursday, June 29th, and an orientation on Saturday, July 8th. The Academy itself will be weekdays from July 19th through the 28th. Voyage of Learning 2006 is sponsored by the University of Missouri, St. Louis, Forest Park Forever, and numerous other organizations.
The following program is a recorded broadcast. Please do not attempt to call the program. Phone lines are not open.
You can purchase Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's book. It's called Human Rights and Human Dignity. Directly through our radio program, we'll send you the book for a contribution of $30 to Issues Etc. The price does include shipping and handling. All you have to do is have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready, and call us at our Issues Etc. resource line. Here's the number, toll-free, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. The book's called Human Rights and Human Dignity by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. The number again, 1-800-737-0172. Dr. Montgomery, historically, how has Christianity fared on the issue of human rights? What's its track record?
It's been very good. The fact is that the criticisms often presented don't take into account the cultural conditions of the time. For example, at the time of the Crusades or during the time of the witch trials and that sort of thing, where the problems were created by Christians, unfortunately, not bringing their principles to bear as they should on cultural conditions that were virtually universal. But once you've taken that into account, the Christian record is perfectly remarkable. For example, if you go to Kenneth Scott La Tourette's 7-volume History of the Expansion of Christianity, La Tourette of Yale, this is the greatest most extensive history of the Christian church that's been done in English. If you go to that, there are incidents after incidents of human rights activities by Christians unparalleled elsewhere. For example, the Red Cross, perfectly clear example. The Red Cross, its very symbol is that of the cross of Christ, doing humanitarian work under the most difficult war conditions.
What about the legal systems of nations that have been heavily influenced by a Judeo-Christian worldview? Legally, how have human rights fared?
Among the major legal systems of the world, the two that are preeminent in preserving civil liberties on the basis of the biblical tradition are the civil law tradition of continental Europe and the common law tradition of England, America, and the English Commonwealth and former Commonwealth countries. These are the great beacon lights of human rights among legal systems of the world. The other systems, Jewish law, Muslim law, Soviet law, unfortunately have not come anywhere near the civil and common law traditions in that respect.
What about religious rights and tolerance? How has Christianity fared there with regard to that particular human right?
Very well. We've never had a situation paralleling, for example, Islam, where it's been customary to enforce conversions by the sword. There certainly have been situations, for example, in 16th and 17th century Europe, where the principle of cuius regio, eius religio prevailed, that is to say, the sovereign could determine the official religion of his subjects. That meant that there was the freedom, as one wag has put it, to emigrate. If your sovereign suddenly changed, let's say, from Roman Catholic to Lutheran, and you were Roman Catholic, the best thing to do was to depart and go to a Roman Catholic state.
That certainly doesn't look like religious tolerance and freedom like we see today in America or Great Britain.
No, that's perfectly right. And eventually, that principle was seen to be inconsistent with Christian faith, and Christians stood up against that sort of thing. The Christians who were particularly strong in that respect, interestingly enough, were those of Baptistic background, perhaps understandably because they were the ones who suffered a great deal of persecution as a result of this principle. You know, in American history, Rhode Island was established by the Baptist Roger Williams, who got sick and tired of the very dominating attitude of Puritans in the Massachusetts colony.
What about freedom of the press or of speech?
Well, those were particularly brought into play in England in the 17th and 18th centuries. There's a statue very close to our flat in London of a man by the name of Wilkes, who was one of the great fighters for freedom of speech in Parliament. And these people would always appeal to the freedom which God gives to people to make decisions. You know, our Lord says, if any man wills to do my will, he shall hear of the doctrine. He shall know of the doctrine, whether I speak of myself or of God. And you have presupposed in Scripture the right of people to make such decisions.
Let's move on to Islam. What has been the track record of Islam on the issue of human rights?
Well, it's been very grim. Some years ago, I was on a program with Sir Norman Anderson, who was director of the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies at the University of London. He was knighted because he was the greatest authority on Muslim law outside of the Muslim world. He passed away just a couple of years ago. And in my Human Rights and Human Dignity, I quote from him, and this is a person who is respected in the Muslim world as well. Listen to some of this. The cast-iron view of predestination supported by the Quran has led to a fatalism which plays a large part in the daily lives of millions of Muslims. To this, the lethargy and lack of progress, which until recently at least has for centuries characterized Muslim countries, can be partially attributed. Islam sanctions slavery and the slave trade, the unlimited right of concubinage, which a Muslim enjoys with his female slaves. This extends even to married women captured in war, opened the door to terrible abuse during the early wars of expansion when almost any woman in a conquered land could be considered a slave by capture. Punishments or criminal sanctions are ghastly. These provided her alia for the murderer to be executed by the family of his victim, for one who causes physical injury to another to be submitted to the like, for the thief to have his right hand cut off, and for the adulterer to be stoned and the fornicator beaten. And he goes on to point out that there's no Muslim human rights system as such. When I was director of studies at the International Institute of Human Rights in Strasbourg, we would occasionally have a Muslim lecturer come in and try to speak on human rights. Problem was that there really weren't any. This was sort of like the German Encyclopedia of Humor, which is only 25 pages in length and half of them are blank. It's awfully difficult to find anything in Islam that can compare with the Christian standards in this regard.
Have any Muslim-dominated nations, I'm thinking about maybe modern-day Turkey, signed on to international human rights accords?
Well, in the case of Turkey, Turkey has just ratified the European Convention on Human Rights as a step to becoming a member of the Council of Europe. But you have to realize that Turkey is not officially a Muslim country. Turkey was secularized by Ataturk in the 1920s, and he expressly made it a non-Muslim state. Most of the population are Muslim, but they stand over against countries like Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia, where there have been efforts, of course, to create a thoroughgoing Muslim state. Years ago, I was invited by President Sadat of Egypt to meet with him at his home in Aswan on the Near East crisis. And about a year after that, he was assassinated by Muslim fanatics who want to turn Egypt into a Muslim state.
Is there religious freedom or freedom of the press in predominantly Muslim-controlled countries?
Well, if the control is exercised by Orthodox Muslims, there will not be. In December, there was a press release here in the UK. I will read you a line or two of this. British parliamentarians raised grave concerns about the systematic extermination of the Christian community in the Moluccas Islands and the mass forced conversions to Islam currently being imposed on thousands of Moluccan Christians by Islam. The parliamentary debate was, and so forth. That's just one example. I'm sure most of the listeners realize that in Pakistan, which is a Muslim country, there have been Christians put on trial for their lives as a result of their simply proclaiming the gospel of Christ.
One religion that is stepping onto the stage of world religions rather quickly, still small but growing and international, is Mormonism. In its short history, what kind of track record does it have on human rights?
Well, it's because it focuses on the Book of Mormon as the completion of Scripture and the interpreter of Scripture. It takes its view of human rights from the Book of Mormon, and there really is not much on human rights in the Book of Mormon. And the result of this has been, for example, that in Utah, there has been a dreadful domination of husbands and fathers over their wives and children, where where the wives and children have simply not been able to function as normal human beings. The Muslims always present themselves as a great family religion, but the fact of the matter is it's been a horror for many wives who have been brought virtually to the status of slaves. They are not able to question their husband's judgment. They are able to be ordered to do whatever. And, of course, the background of polygamy hasn't helped any.
Well, I guess if your husband's on his way to becoming God, according to Mormon teaching, it would be hard to question him.
Well, quite.
My guest is Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. We're talking about world religions and human rights. When we come back from the break, in the last 10 minutes of our conversation, we'll turn our attention east toward another world religion, Buddhism. How has it fared? What's its track record on human rights? In the countries where Buddhism is dominant, how do the people live? What rights are recognized? Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest, Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's also barrister at law in England and Wales and member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of 50 books, including his own Human Rights and Human Dignity. When we come back, we'll look at Buddhism, and if we have time, we're going to talk about a few aberrations among Christian in nations where Christians dominate. Aberrations by Christians on the basis of human rights. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Well, I'm glad Jesus didn't feel that way about you.
Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, responding to the idea that the AIDS crisis is self-inflicted and Christians need not respond in love.
Look, you reap what you sow. You're a sinner. You're damned to hell. Go rot. That's not Jesus. And the Bible doesn't tell us, Jesus says, you made your bed, now lie in it, I'm not going to help. So it's an impossible response for a Christian, even though we know that actions have consequences. But consequences, those consequences don't kill mercy and don't kill a proclamation of the law in order to bring the gospel.
Find LCMS World Relief at our homepage, issuesetc.org, Christ-centered, cross-focused, love for the neighbor.
The following program is a recorded broadcast. Please do not attempt to call the program. Phone lines are not open.
If you're looking for an opportunity to sharpen your apologetic skills, your ability to defend the Christian faith against other world religions and worldviews, then you need to consider attending the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. It's held annually in Strasbourg, France. The Academy takes place next summer, July the 9th through the 20th in Strasbourg. Lecturers include Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, our guest in this hour, Craig Parton, Greg Kokel, and Dr. Gary Habermas. They're all regular guests here on Issues Etc. There are only 4 slots available for this summer's Academy, so don't procrastinate. If you're thinking about doing it, don't put it off. Ask for a free information brochure on the 6th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. And all you got to do is call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172, or check out our Issues Etc. website at issuesetc.org. There's a section there titled What's New. Under that section, if you click there, you'll find a direct link to the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Dr. Montgomery, how have Buddhism and other Eastern religions fared on the issue of human rights?
Very badly. I did a book some years ago entitled Giant in Chains, China Today and Tomorrow, because my wife and I were in Beijing at the same time as the hideous Tiananmen Square massacre. And in this book, I went into quite a bit of detail on Buddhism, because Chinese Buddhism is very important. I was amazed at the contribution that Buddhism has made to a poor human rights record in countries where it exists. Reason for this is that, it's doctrinal, of course. What we do follows from what we believe. Among the noble truths of Buddhism are these. All existence is suffering. Desire is the cause of suffering. All suffering will therefore cease when we suppress all desires. Now, what that's produced culturally is a withdrawal. Because notice, it isn't bad desires that create the problem, it's any desires at all. So if you, let's say, desire to engage in social improvement, if you want to improve conditions or change things as they are, that's a desire, and that's going to produce personal suffering. So the tendency in countries where Buddhism prevails is for people to back away from social problems, to leave things in the mess they're in. The sad part about this is that they then fall naturally into whatever political or social ideology happens to be prevalent. So Buddhists in China went along with the imperial evils, then later on they went along with the Maoist and communist evils. They have not developed any kind of transcendent standard by which they can oppose human rights violations.
So Eastern religions, Buddhism in particular, will in a situation of human rights violated tolerate the status quo and then tolerate whatever comes along, worse or better, to replace the status quo.
Yes, this is right. And along with that is the contribution of a undefined, vague mysticism, which doesn't help matters. Arthur Koestler, the author of Darkness at Noon, the novelist, after he spent 10 years in Marxism and found that that was a very, very poor worldview, went to the Far East in order to drink at the founts of Eastern wisdom. And he found gurus there, among the gurus was a woman. She was a guruess, I guess. And he spent a half an hour with her after climbing up this mountain. And during the half hour, she said absolutely nothing but picked her toenail. And on the way back down the mountain, Koestler was somewhat discouraged. And the monk who had taken him up said, "She was telling you something." But we never discovered what it was, and neither did Koestler. In a context like that, you don't exactly have an incentive to correct human rights abuses. And Koestler went on to do his book, The Lotus and the Robot, in which he said the trouble with this religion is that it really has no ethic at all. And that's why there were Zen Buddhist kamikaze pilots in the Second World War.
But is the great contribution that Christianity has made toward the concept of human rights, the foundation that it stands as for the concept of human rights, is it based merely upon the ethics of Christianity?
Oh, no, not at all. The source of human rights is in creation, but human rights has two foci. One of these is creation, the other is redemption. The problem in human rights fundamentally is that even when we know what we should do, even if we understand what human rights principles are properly, we still don't act that way. And therefore, the answer to the problem of human rights is ultimately the need for a personal transformation. We need to be changed so that we really will consider our neighbor as the same as ourselves. We will do unto him as we would have him do unto us. And that can't be created by manipulating the environment or by education or anything like that. The only way for that to occur is to have a fundamental change in the human heart. And that means that for success in the human rights area, you need salvation. You need salvation. That's the thing that can provide the motivation to carry out the principles.
Someone would approach this conversation and have been listening for the last hour or so and say, look, I'm all for human rights as you have laid them out. I'm all for it. Sounds great. But I'm not a Christian. In fact, I'm an atheist. And I'm still all for human rights. How would you answer such a person?
Well, of course, I would praise the person for having such high ethical standards. I would then, however, ask them why they have chosen those standards rather than anything else. In the discussion, I think that I could very easily bring the person to see that unless there is a God, a transcendent God, who has made us in his image, there isn't any basis for those principles. And unless there is a salvation available from our self-centeredness, then we're not going to follow the principles anyway. Therefore, the consistent individual who holds to human rights ought to come to the cross of Christ.
If the person said, I hold to these things because they have been proven throughout history to produce the very best of societies, how would you respond?
Well, I can hardly deny that they have produced the best of societies. But after all, the issue is an issue of truth, isn't it? I mean, suppose we had a society which was very, very wealthy, but the wealth came from a nasty illegal source. We wouldn't continue the nasty illegal source simply because the results were good. The end doesn't justify the means, and we don't want to get into thinking of that sort. Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. We need to examine our beliefs to see if they are true. We don't want to live in deception, even if the deception produces good results.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Always a great pleasure.
Folks, if you'd like to purchase Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's book, it's called Human Rights and Human Dignity, for a total of $30. Or if you'd like information, a brochure on the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, or if you'd just like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, you can call one number. It's our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. There are two reasons why Christians ought to be concerned about human rights, both domestically and internationally. Why this ought to deeply concern us. One is the one that we've laid out in the course of this conversation. The sole basis for such a concept of human rights, as they've been articulated in various bills of rights and declarations of rights, the sole basis and foundation for that is the Judeo-Christian worldview. An acknowledgement of the reality of sin in the world and answering the question, how then shall we live together? And what rights has God afforded each and every individual on the face of this planet that we cannot take away? What are the limits of those rights? And how in law ought we limit those things? It's all based upon Christianity. As it's influenced, Christian by Christian, every culture it's ever been in, where its influence has held sway, then we see human rights flourishing. Not perfectly, but they flourish. Where Christianity is absent or has a small voice, where Buddhism speaks loudly, just look for yourself. How do human rights fare? That's the pragmatic side. The other side of it is this. We do have the command from our Lord Jesus to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. If there were no such thing as human rights, we would still have that. Christ did for us what we did not deserve to have done for us. We were sinners indebted to his Father all the way to death, and he paid by his death the price for our sin. He is the foundation, ultimately, of the rights that we claim. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Pastor Todd Wilkin weekly on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Issues Etc., Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Visit us on the World Wide Web at www.issuesetc.org. That's issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.